Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
On Commons People this week is Tory Sleaze back.
Then after a discussion with the Chancellor, who everybody seems to be lobbying these days, the Prime Minister texted his friend to say it's fixed.
Will Boris Johnson really save football?
These clubs are not just great global brands. Of course they're great global brands. They're also clubs that have originated historically from their towns, from their cities, from their local communities. They should have a link with those fans.
And how bad are things for Labour?
A lot of my voters who I've met felt that Labour has lost its way over the last decade, that nationally we were rubbish, that locally we fell into bad hands, and that together, you know, whether nationally or locally, you know, the town, Labour took the town for granted.
Hello and welcome to Commons People. I'm Arj Singh, and joining me this week is Paul Waugh.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Paul. Rachel Wearmouth is here.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Rachel. And we've got the Labour peer and former Cabinet Minister, Lord Peter Mandelson.
Hi, Arj.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm sitting here in the Golden Lion pub in the north of the town in Hartlepool. It's a brilliant sunny day, fresh breeze coming off the North Sea. And it's great to be back in my old town.
Fantastic. And you are, of course, on the doorstep there for the crucial by-election coming up, which we'll get into later. But first, because since we last recorded the podcast, Westminster has been engulfed in allegations of what Labour is calling Tory sleaze, the lobbying of senior ministers by their ex-colleagues, company bosses and foreign leaders has thrown into the spotlight the so-called revolving door between the public and private sectors. So far, David Cameron has perhaps suffered the most damage amid a string of embarrassing revelations about his lobbying for collapsed finance firm Greensill Capital. But now Boris Johnson's own dealings are being scrutinised following revelations of text exchanges with Saudi leader Mohammed bin Salman over a proposed takeover of Newcastle United and James Dyson over tax rules. Keir Starmer is trying very hard to make it all stick. Let's just have a listen to him.
Mr. Speaker, there's a pattern to this government. The Prime Minister is fixing tax breaks for his friends. The Chancellor is pushing the Treasury to help Lex Greensill. The Health Secretary is meeting Greensill for drinks. And David Cameron's texting anybody who'll reply. Every day, there are new allegations about this Conservative government.
Paul, do you think this issue is getting cut through with the public? Labour thinks it is, or wants it to, at least.
Well, there's only been one poll specifically on Cameron and Greensill so far, and that was a YouGov poll. And to my surprise, it showed 25% of people actually knew the detail of the story. Now, I think that's quite a large figure. I think more than half of the people knew roughly that the story was around. So obviously, it's having some cut through. When I've talked to Keir Starmer's team, the most important thing from their point of view is whenever the story about cronyism, they've been building this picture over the last few months, rather methodically under Rachel Reeves and others, of a picture of mates rates and favours when it comes to things as basic as PPE in the pandemic. And that, when Keir Starmer trialled it first in PMQs just before Christmas in November, when they went to their focus groups, they found an instant reaction that there was cut through to that story. So people are happy to go along with the government, cut them a bit of slack on the pandemic itself. But if there's any hint whatsoever of cronyism and people making money out of public money off the back of the pandemic, profiteering in a sense, in a political way, then the public really don't like it.
Yeah, Peter, your old boss, Tony Blair, said he was finding it difficult to get too worked up about texts between Boris Johnson and James Dyson. Do you agree with him?
I think I'm a bit more concerned than that. I didn't hear what he had to say, but I just don't think that tax breaks for people, whether it be James Dyson or anyone else, should be negotiated by the Prime Minister personally. You know, especially when he's clearly on such friendly terms with them, and certainly not through casual exchanges by WhatsApp. I mean, we live in a properly governed country and democracy. We don't live in a private members club. We live in a country where everyone's rights and treatment are equal before the law. And I think that's how people expect the country to be governed. And I think they'll be rather surprised that you have a prime minister able to conduct this sort of business by WhatsApp with people he's clearly very close to.
Yeah, it's interesting because New Labour was sort of accused of running a sofa-style government with quite informal decision-making.
But it had nothing to do with this, Arch. That was about Prime Minister seeing ministers and civil servants in a relaxed setting. That was actually got up out of nothing. Who cares about the furniture of a room? You know, he had as many meetings around the cabinet table as he did on a sofa. But that's a million miles away from running the government like a private members club, which is what we're seeing now.
And isn't it true, Peter, that Tony Blair didn't even have a mobile phone when he was prime minister? Is that right?
Well, he was sometimes given one. I remember speaking to him on a mobile phone. But I mean, no, usually he would make phone calls. The switchboard at number 10. Would put three people through or get calls for him. But if he was speaking to somebody like this, he would have an official on the line. There's no doubt at all about it. He wouldn't dream of conducting government business in this way. I mean, I don't know what he said yesterday, but I think he was being a tad kind. Look, the truth is that the government's just been in power for too long, isn't it? I mean, they've forgotten what standards are, and if they haven't forgotten them, they certainly don't think they apply to them anymore. And it's what happens when a party's been in power for as long as they have, without, for a lot of the time, I have to say, an effective opposition for a lot of it. I mean, he may not think that the rules apply to him, Boris Johnson, but, you know, I think they're going to catch up with him. He's going to find out what the rules are. And he's going to be reminded what standards and integrity in government means to people. And he'll be reminded in the ballot box. If not now, then he will be later.
Yeah. Do you think, Peter, actually, the interesting thing about this is this WhatsApp-style sense of government stems in a way from David Cameron's time, where apparently he used to text people all the time on his mobile phone, partly to get around the fact that they're in a coalition. He didn't want to share messages with his Lib Dem colleagues.
That's politics, Paul.
Yeah.
You know, he's entitled to go around the back of his a coalition colleagues if he wants. What he's not allowed to do is to go round the back of his own officials. That's outside the ministerial code. That's not how we do things in this country. That's not how we conduct business. He knows it. I think this is a real wake-up call, quite honestly. And I suspect that the cabinet secretary will be telling them that this is not what the public expect. This is not the standards by which government operates in this country, and they've got to change.
Yeah, Peter, I mean, what can we actually do about this? Because the Prime Minister is the ultimate arbiter of the ministerial code, isn't he? And in the modern era, is it perhaps inevitable that, you know, business is going to be done via text message? I mean, so much
no,
of our lives...
No, it's not inevitable. It's only inevitable when you've got a party that, you know, thinks that you can operate government as if you're providing a special VIP service lane for donors and cronies. If that's how you want government to operate, then fine, do it by WhatsApp. But that is not how we've done it in this country before, and it's not how we should be doing it in the future. And I can tell you something. I mean, whatever anyone says about Keir Starmer, one thing is for sure, he wouldn't be running a government in this way. I mean, he's a guy with impeccable standards. He's been a director of public prosecutions. He knows how to do things properly, and he would organize his government and expect very, very much, very different standards from ministers in any administration he's head of. Of that, I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever.
Yeah, Rachel, I just wanted to ask you, why do you think Labour's going so hard at this? Is it because it worked in the 90s? And Peter kind of gave an impression that, you know, he said it's a sign of a tired Tory government that's been in power too long, which was very much the argument in the 90s before Blair came to power.
I think it's really fertile ground for the Labour Party because of that, yeah. And I think when you look, I think Labour would probably point to some of the accusations the government has faced of this pork barrel politics as well, and just the overall feeling of whether or not the government is being fair with things like the Towns Fund, for example. The last tranche of funding was like, when you look at the sort of the 45 different towns that were sharing some of this £1 billion shared prosperity fund, 40 of the 45 towns chosen had at least one Conservative MP. So I think it raises, it's helpful to Labour Party in that it can raise further questions about how this government is conducting government altogether. And I think just for Labour as well, it's the kind of criticism and the kind of area for the party that can unite all wings of the party. So I think it's very, very helpful for them at the moment, in that sort of it gets a lot of those people, their activists, out on the doorstep, because it's something they can really get behind.
Yeah, really interesting.
Peter, it's worth asking, you know, how shocked, if not shocked at all, were you in PMQs to hear yourself name-checked, that you've still got that pulling power when Boris Johnson accused you of being a lobbyist the other week?
Yeah, I'm not actually a lobbyist, but it doesn't matter. He's always been a stranger to the truth, as Boris. I mean, you know, you, one thing you wouldn't expect Boris to do is to be anything other than completely economical in his approach to the truth, would you? And if you had a problem with standards and integrity in government, he's not the man you'd turn to put it right, is he? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, I've been on the doorstep this morning talking to my former voters. What struck me about a whole number of comments they made is that they didn't expect anything better. I mean, yes. One guy said, you know, Johnson will say he'll do anything that pleases him. He's not serious, is he? Another guy said, you know, my house needs decorating. You know, can he get one of Boris's mates to give me a bunch of money to do my house up? I mean, it's partly, you know, flippant. It's partly making a joke of it. But it also reflects something else, which is that they don't actually have very high expectations of Boris. And to be honest, they don't have very high expectations of politicians as a whole. And I think that reflects a poor state of politics in our country.
Yeah, does that make it hard for Labour to make this stick or to make it have an electoral impact?
I don't think it makes it hard for it to stick because it speaks for itself. I don't think they have to make it stick because it's sticking whatever they say or do. But one thing is clear to me is that Tory sleaze is not going to win the next election for Labour. I mean, it will loosen and crumble a lot of support for the Tories, and people will reach the conclusion that they're out for themselves and they suit themselves and they fill the pockets of their own cronies and supporters. That's true. But that doesn't mean to say that Labour's just, you know, got to sit back and wait for the election to fall into their laps. That's not how you win elections. So, fine. Make the point, but you've got to present a credible and attractive alternative if you want people to vote for you. So Labour is climbing back from quite a trough that we climbed into and made for ourselves, both here locally and nationally. And it takes time to rebuild trust. It takes time to win back that confidence. And I'm hearing that on the doorstep here.
Yeah, and we'll get into that in a bit more detail later. But first, after weeks of the lobbying scandal dominating the news, it would have needed to be a seismic story to knock it off the front pages. And it was perhaps predictable that this would come from the world of elite football, as the so-called Big Six English clubs threatened to join a breakaway European Super League that would have killed competition as we know it in the sport. Boris Johnson wasted no time in making clear his opposition, threatening a legislative bomb to halt the plans. And as rival fans and political parties united in disgust at the club's greed, the so-called Super League collapsed in disgrace just 72 hours after emerging in the news. Many fans will hope this is a watershed moment for change in an increasingly money-dominated sport. Let's hear Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden on that.
Yes, I think it's really important that we don't just say, well, this is all over with, forget about it. I announced on Monday that Tracy Crouch would be leading this fan-led review. That will essentially look at finance, it will look at governance, and it will look at the fan experience of football, because my whole experience as Secretary of State, both dealing with this and dealing with the challenges we had with football and financing it during the COVID crisis, I think there is a real need to look at this properly now.
Paul, the government went all out on this full-scale intervention, at least they threatened a full-scale intervention, and it surprised some on the right of the Tory party. What do you think it kind of means for politics in a general sense, how the Tories have handled this?
Well, I think it tells you a couple of things. One is that the public actually quite like state intervention of some kinds, whether it's furlough or whether it's something like this, the threat of state intervention. Normally, football fans will run a mile from any politician trying to politicise their sport. But this was so big, so huge, you saw sort of effectively a counter-revolution almost. But the second point is that actually... it shows what a good politician Boris Johnson is, I'm afraid, which is that, you know, he saw that public mood and he acted on it. And he said, roughly, this, to be frank, I think the sort of things that maybe even Tony Blair would have said, which is, look, you've got a prime minister in power. He sees this popular upswelling of opinion, real emotion, and felt actually... what role can I play? Well, it's ultimately down to the clubs to sort it out, but I will give them the authorities my support. And if they don't get what they want, then I've got this legislative stick or bomb to plant. And I thought that was quite effective. Now, Johnson obviously tried to do a bit of a victory lap about it yesterday. It'd be interesting to see whether or not he gets any credit from the voters or the football fans, who, as I say, are deeply cynical ultimately about most politicians. So maybe that might not pay off. But it, apparently from Tory MPs are saying that it has paid off in some sense, that they're picking up that you know, he's on their side, and he showed it, even though, crucially, he didn't pretend to be a football fan either. And so I think, you know, that might make a difference.
Paul, don't you think this is a whole load of hypocrisy? This is the guy, the Prime Minister, putting himself on the side of football fans and supporters. How many months ago was he exchanging WhatsApp messages with the Saudi Crown Prince, the strongman who rules Saudi Arabia, and saying, if I can give you any help to deliver Newcastle United into your hands, just let me know?
Yeah.
Those were WhatsApp messages that came into the media, the other week. So there he is on the one hand saying, oh, I'm on the side of the supporters, the fans, I'm on the side of the game. This shouldn't be run like an elite business. But just cast your mind back to his WhatsApp messages when he was trying to do exactly that. Deliver another major British club into the hands of a foreign investor.
Yeah. But isn't that the challenge, Peter, that actually he is a chameleon? He does say one thing 6 months ago and then he changes and he gets
away
with it.
Well, that's all right then.
No, but isn't that the...
He gets away with it whilst there's no credible alternative who people can turn to. And the truth is that increasingly people are seeing Labour as a credible alternative. They do see Keir Starmer as a man of principles and of integrity, but they want to know a lot more about him and what he believes in and what the policies of the Labour Party will be at the next election before they're prepared to transfer their allegiance to him and to the Labour Party. And that's why the Labour Party's got work on its hands. That's why we've got a mountain to climb. And we've got to do it. And we've got to do it, in my view, with greater intensity and more speed and more focus than we've been doing at any time during the last year. But what's been happening in the last year? We've had a COVID crisis. We've had a pandemic. In a sense, it's sort of made Labour and its leaders sort of almost hermetically sealed away from normal day-to-day politics because they've been everyone's been focused on the pandemic. Fine. Well, we're coming out of that now, thank goodness. And now the Labour Party's got to turn back to the job it has on its hands, which is to restore confidence and credibility in it so that people feel they have a really strong alternative to turn to. And that, in my view, they will do as long as Labour Party earns that support.
Yeah, Peter, I just wanted to ask you about the power of using sport for political advantage. Tony Blair and New Labour understood it, but Boris Johnson appears to be understanding it now. But do you think it could backfire? Is it a risky approach, particularly if, for example, the government's fans-led review of football, for example, doesn't go far enough? Does he need to back it up with action, or is this kind of...
Of course he does. Like everything else, he's very good, with the soundbite. And he speaks off the top of his head, I'll do this, I'll do that, I'll deliver this, I'll give you the other. All too often it's not followed up. And I think football fans will remember what he said, and they'll expect the government to deliver. Look, I'm not a football man myself, but I know a little bit about politics and communications. And I certainly know that the elite investors and owners of these clubs are a world away from the public whose support they rely on, you know, in the game itself. A world away, completely disconnected. So Boris Johnson, he could see that straight away, and he knew which side he had to put himself on. But now he's got to deliver. Yet again, he's made promises off the top of his head. I remember him standing outside Downing Street and saying, oh, we've got this great, great plan for social care for the elderly. It's been ignored for too long. Well, I've got a plan and we're going to implement it. You know, what are we, 2 years on? No sign of any plan whatsoever. Why? Because it never existed in the first place. What existed was a soundbite. What existed was something that he knew people wanted to hear. What he didn't have was a set of policies to carry out and be true to what he was promising. And he does this time and time again. And the truth catches up with you. If not this, it will be something else. And he'll find by the time of the next election, people will be judging him, not by his words, but by his performance and what he's delivered.
Yeah, interesting. Rachel, do you think this will be a watershed moment for football? Do you think Johnson's really prepared to intervene at the level that might be required? Peter obviously thinks not.
Well, when I was up in Darlington yesterday and speaking to football fans, and they were just outraged, and it was the main subject that people wanted to talk about. They were just outraged at the Super League generally, at the fact that you could get into this league and not be relegated, the lack of fairness, just, you know, after years of being treated with contempt by the owners of football clubs. I would just say separately, as a Newcastle fan, I was kind of sat here nodding everything Peter said about Bin Salman and Boris Johnson. But I think the big risk for the Prime Minister in this is the disappointment that he could risk by raising hopes so far that the government can make such big changes in football. You know, these are fans that kind of have thought through every possible option that could come out of a fans review, and they some of them are realistic and some of them aren't. And I just think if the reforms don't really deliver for fans, I think their hopes are really, really high, they're going to be very, very disappointed.
Yeah. But Rachel, these reforms and the way they run football in Germany is very, very different, isn't it?
Yeah.
So you've got a workable model in Germany. Why can't we have that here?
But I think there'll be some clubs that will want that and others that won't, if they feel like it risks them not being able to bring in the big players. You know, it's a difficult issue for a government to try and tackle at all, I think. And football fans' expectations are going to be very, very high.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting as well, because I believe, Rachel, the Saudis are coming back in for Newcastle at the moment, or will be soon. Do people think Boris Johnson will have to then comment on that and take a position on that? I don't know, Paul.
He's already taken a position on it, Arch. Just read his WhatsApp. He's taken a position. I'll do everything I can for you. It's yours. Yours for the asking. Here it is on a plate. Thank you. Goodbye.
Well, despite the lobbying scandal and Labour allegations of cronyism during the pandemic, things seem to be getting better in the polls for Boris Johnson. The latest YouGov poll gave the Tories a whopping 14-point lead on Labour nationally, and it sets up a worrying couple of weeks for Keir Starmer in the run-up to May's local elections, and in particular the by-election in Peter Zulci of Hartlepool, as we've been discussing. Let's just listen to the Tory candidate for the seat, though, Jill Mortimer, on a bit of a sticky wicket when asked if she would nationalise Liberty Steel, which employs hundreds in Hartlepool and is under threat following the collapse of Greensill Capital. Let's have a listen.
I don't know if that's the right way to go. To be completely honest with you, I don't know enough about it to give you a full comment on that at the moment.
You don't know enough about Liberty Steel. There were 250 people employed.
I know enough about Liberty Steel, but not about whether we should nationalise it. I'm not a great nationaliser of industries. I think they're much better. They are more streamlined and perform better in private ownership.
But if that's what it took to save 250 jobs here in Hartlepool?
I'd have to see more evidence to come to a proper conclusion.
Paul, we had the Tory polling expert Lord Hayward on the podcast just before Easter, and he was massively downplaying the chances of his party winning in Hartlepool. Do you think he might be feeling a bit more optimistic now?
Well, I'll preface everything I say by deferring to Peter's extensive knowledge of this subject for obvious reasons. But I mean, my feeling was, and I've felt this all along, that, you know, Labour shouldn't really be even in the territory of thinking it can lose Hartlepool. If you're not going to lose Hartlepool at the height of unpopularity of Jeremy Corbyn in 2019, at the height of Brexit as a huge issue, and you still win by nearly 4,000 votes, then, you know, to me, if they do lose it, there's something very, very seriously wrong. You can't blame that on the pandemic. There's got to be something a bit more systemic there that maybe Labour's going to have to look at, whether it's Keir Starmer, as Peter says, being much more proactive about saying what he stands for. You can't trade on this excuse for very long, much longer now. The idea that in a pandemic, you know, the government gets all the attention, that's becoming rather than the reason a lame excuse if that does materialise. I'm not saying it will, but I think that, I don't know. I think the curious thing is going to be just where that old Brexit vote goes, and whether or not in 2019, you know, that was split evenly between Tories and Labour, and also all those people who sat at home and just sat out the by-election because they were unhappy with Corbyn. If Labour gets even a chunk of those people back, surely Labour should be increasing its majority. I don't know what Peter thinks. I mean, do you think a win is a win, Peter? One vote, majority is as good as 10,000?
Look, all I know is that Labour's in a real fight in Hartlepool. It may or may not surprise you, but in 2019, the combined Tory and Brexit party vote completely outgunned Labour. We got a 37% only share of the vote. It was the fourth lowest of any Labour-held seat in the country. And we're fighting against a headwind now, not just of what's gone wrong with for Labour in the past, both nationally and locally here in Hartlepool, Brexit and Jeremy Corbyn's leadership, but we're also now fighting against a headwind which is being created by the vaccine reprieve, which has given a bounce to the Tories. There's no doubt at all about that. I have found, even this morning, the memory of Jeremy Corbyn is still strong on the doorsteps amongst Labour voters here. It's still coming up. And I'm afraid we've got some way to go before we rebuild the confidence and trust that was taken, that we just threw away during the last five or so years. So we've got a great team here. We've got a very strong message, in my view, an excellent candidate in Paul Williams. He's going down well on the doorstep. But as I say, we're fighting Tories who've been boosted in recent years. And we've got that vaccine bounce to take on currently. So nobody can take this seat for granted, not Labour nor the Tories.
And would you be happy with a majority of just one?
I'd like a majority which is a darn sight larger than one, thank you very much. And that's why I'm on my third visit and working very hard. And reminding people, by the way, of what a Labour government did for this town when we were in power. We rebuilt the schools, we rebuilt the hospital. You know, we put in new NHS healthcare infrastructure in the town. What have we had since over the last 10 years? You know, we've had the hospital run down. We've had the magistrates' court closed in Hartlepool. We've got the police custody cells taken out of Hartlepool and put elsewhere. We've had a lot of the civic infrastructure and fabric of this town taken out of Hartlepool by the austerity years under the Tories. And people feel this very strongly. But at the same time, and I'm going to be honest with you about this, they do feel let down by Labour. And it's that trust that we've got to rebuild. We've got to earn it afresh. Now, we've had a year of doing that under Keir Starmer, but it's going to take longer to do the job completely. And that's why, as I say, we're fighting, we've got a real fight on our hands here, and we're swimming against quite strong headwinds. But we are fighting very hard, as I say. The campaign and the candidate are good here, but if we lose it, and on balance, I think we're going to win, but if we lose it, it will be because of national factors and past factors affecting Labour in the town, not by the state of the Labour Party now.
Rachel, you're up there, or you've been up there in recent days and weeks. What's your sense of how it's going on the ground?
I think that Peter's right. It is very, very tough for Labour. I think one thing that people who are not from the North East don't realise is that even though we've had a Conservative government for, you know, more than 10 years, it's Labour is the establishment in the North East. So throughout the austerity years, the most seats have had a Labour MP and a Labour council. And it feels to a lot of local people that everything is run by Labour. And I would also say that, yeah, there's the vaccine bounce, but there's also the Ben Houchen bounce, which is a really big deal. You know, a lot of people in sort of the south of Durham and Teesside, you know, look to the Conservative Party mayor for the Tees Valley, Ben Houchen, as having brought in lots and lots of investment. And even though you would sort of break down some of that and argue that it hasn't created a very many jobs just yet, there's just an awful lot of positivity around everything that he's done since he won the seat. And he seems on course to win again. In just a few weeks' time and win quite handsomely. And he's quite a big deal on Teesside, this guy, the Tory mayor.
Rachel, I don't disagree with you about Ben Houchen, but his fame and delivery does not yet reach Hartlepool. I mean, he's very much round Tees Valley, Tees Estuary, Teesside Airport. He's not yet Hartlepool, and he talks.
But isn't one of the problems?
He talks a big game about his free port. But the Freeport stretches to Hartlepool only in name. And that Freeport and all the tax perks and advantages that come with businesses locating in it require a lot of investment in infrastructure, new making up land and buildings for businesses. That has yet to come anywhere near Hartlepool. At the moment, it's round the Tees and around the airport. It's not round us in here in this town. So I take your point. He's been apparently quite a successful mayor in the sense that he's got a good name for himself. But what he's actually done and delivered has yet to reach this town.
But isn't one of the problems that you have is that sort of voters in Hartlepool are looking and seeing that it is that everything that Ben seems to have been working on is on areas that are now Tory held, and they're thinking, oh, if I could vote Conservative, maybe things would change for Hartlepool. Is that one of the problems that you have?
I had a voter this morning who said, you know what the Tories are like. They just get their snouts in the trough. Well, perhaps it's our turn. Perhaps we should get our noses in the our snouts in the trough as well, because what they see is quite a lot of pork barrel politics being thrown around the place. Now, will that be enough to deliver a Tory majority in this town? I don't think so. Is it a factor? Yes, and it's something the Tories are playing up for all it's worth during this campaign. I acknowledge that. That's what they're saying. That's what they're trying to get people to believe and to vote for. But you know what you've got offsetting that is a very good Labour candidate who people like, a doctor who's been working in the COVID care clinic in the General Hospital here in Hartlepool for the last year, who provides a strong voice for the town and a pair of very sharp elbows. You'll really fight for the town, and that's what people like as well. So there are votes up not yet decided, and I know what the Tories are saying, but on the other side of the ledger you've got a very strong Labour candidate and campaign.
One thing I did observe while I was up there is Ben Houchen, the mayor, doesn't really seem to be campaigning that hard for Jill Mortimer, the Conservative candidate for Hartlepool.
I don't think Ben Houchen's come to the town. I'm not actually sure whether the Tory candidate herself has come to the town very much. She was first interviewed and she was asked what she knew about Hartlepool. She said, absolutely nothing, but I hope to learn. Well, she hasn't gained much knowledge through very many visits here. Now, there's very little Tory presence in the town. There's nothing on the streets. They do it by social media, you know, email. They haven't got Tory workers and activists on the streets here in the way that Labour has.
Peter, I just wanted to broaden the kind of debate about what Labour needs to do out a little bit. One thing that Keir Starmer has been, or Labour have been criticised for in recent weeks has been the fact that the shadow cabinet, no one knows who they are. You were in, you know, cabinets of a lot of big hitters in politics. Do you think Keir Starmer needs to freshen things up there?
Well, he'll know what to do when the time comes, and I'm not going to start giving him advice or lectures about how he should do his job. All I know is this, that people want Labour to make the weather. You know, it's not just, you know, sounding and looking like, you know, the right thing in the right place at the right time, and you're responding to this and you're finding the right way to react to that. They want Labour to make the news. They want the Tories properly taken apart. If you're a Labour person, or if you're anti-Tory and you want to see a proper attack being mounted on the Tory party, you'll expect it from Labour, and Labour's got to deliver that. If it falls short, if it's a bit weak, if it's a bit flabby, if it appears not to know how to use the media well, you know, if it's not doing its opposition research well, and honing its attacks and creating the ammunition with people strong enough to fire that ammunition in the Tory direction, then people are going to say, well, are Labour strong enough? So you have got to, in politics, we live in a very adversarial business in politics. And people judge you and your strength and your effectiveness by what you say and how you take on your opponents, the arguments that you can form and deploy, and then, of course, most importantly, the alternatives that you're offering. And what people want to see in the Labour Party is a party that can and will take on the Tories effectively and play them at their own game. They also want a party that's modern, that's fair, and that provides strong leadership. That's how they'll make up their minds at the end of the day, and that's how Labour is going to win the next election. People want to, they look to the Labour Party to create a dynamic economy in this country. They want and expect social justice and policies for that from the Labour Party. They also expect the Labour Party to understand what aspiration means, that people want to do better for themselves and their families, and they want everyone else to operate on the basis of fair rules when it comes to immigration or crime or welfare. They want fair rules applied to everyone. Now, that's what they expect from, and the reason why they will vote for the Labour Party. But the Labour Party's got to come across much more strongly. It's got plenty of time to do so between now and the next election, but they've got to put in place a much more effective electoral political fighting machine in order to make that impact across the country, not just in the cities where Labour's doing well, not just amongst the higher educated, where Labour's also getting support, ethnic minorities, where we're also drawing a lot of support. We've got to widen that basis of support to the towns, not just the cities, and the towns in the Midlands and the North, and not just the university towns. So again, where we've got plenty of support. We've got to get back onto the cultural, political, social wavelength of an awful lot of people from whom we've become completely disconnected, not just over the last 5 years, but actually to a certain extent over the last 10 years as well. We've got a lot of ground to make up, and we're not going to do that unless we recreate that cultural connection that we lost during those years from so many people who were taken for granted that they were Labour supporters, but then saw a Labour Party, which when they listened to it and saw it, they didn't quite recognise. And that's what we've got to repair.
Peter, can I ask you just on a totally lighter note, completely different note? I mean, we got you on.
Am I being too serious for you? I'm so
sorry. No, I was going to say, I can't have you on this
politics
podcast.
Politics is a serious business, you know.
I get that.
I want my party to win. I'm fed up with losing. I'm fed to the back teeth with losing. I want to see my party winning again. And that's why I'm here and that's why I work for it. Anyway, what did you want to ask?
I was going to say, do you think enough of your colleagues share that sense of being fed up of opposition? And sometimes it's just been too easy. They've seemed to like being in opposition almost.
You don't win elections by going through the motions.
Yeah.
You don't win elections, you know, by saying, you know, nice things about yourself. You've got to go for your, you've got to go for your opponents as well. Turn them inside out, strip them down, lay them bare, and see what see what they stand for and what they're not doing for this country. And then people will look to you. And when they do look to you, you better have a credible, affordable, radical set of modern policies for people to vote for. And that's what Labour's got to create over the next year or so.
Well, what I was going to raise was the lovely issue of guacamole and mushy peas. Given that I was going to raise this was because you are the person who actually put it out there originally in your original Sunday People column, as we all know. I was just going to ask you, this story, obviously, it's a myth and it stemmed from an American Labour Party worker in Knowsley, and it's nothing to do with Hartlepool, nothing to do with you. But you wrote about it in the People because it was in the Hartlepool Mail. Is that right?
Do you know what I had last night here in the town for my dinner?
Guacamole.
Hartlepool cod and mushy peas. No guacamole to be seen. No, I did write about it because it became a joke. When I left the Labour Party as its campaign director in 1991 or whatever it was, Neil Kinnock gave a little party for the whole of the media, the parliament, the lobby of journalists in Westminster. And at my farewell party, he brought in a wonderful haddock, I think it was, and mushy peas, wrapped up in a copy of that day's Daily Mirror, and presented it to me to remind everyone of the joke that was first said about that American intern in the Knowsley by-election in 1986. And forever since, it's attached itself to me. And do I mind? No, I don't. I love laughing at myself.
But Peter, which do you prefer, mushy peas or guacamole?
Actually, do you want to know, Arj?
Yes.
I love the mushy peas last night. They were brilliant. So I'm now a fully reconverted mushy pea man, especially when they're served up with battered Hartlepool cod.
Fantastic. Okay, it's time for the quiz, and it's on my favourite topic again, politics and football. So the first question, just shout the answer if you know it. The fans of which team sing Labour anthem, the red flag, during games?
No idea.
I don't know. Corbynistas United?
I'd be surprised if no one gets this, given the
Liverpool.
No.
Oh really?
No idea.
Oh, it's Sunderland.
Oh God, yeah, they do. Yeah.
Oh, great bunch. Great
question. Oh shush.
question number two: Argentine football legend Diego Maradona once said his hand of God goal was revenge for what?
Oh, the Falklands.
Well done, Paul. Point for you. And the final question, Gordon Brown once played table tennis, quite badly, I should add, with which football manager?
Oh,
blimey.
I don't know.
Kirkcaldy Wanderers?
Yeah. Yeah, was it? Who could that be?
Rosyth United? I don't know. Who is it? I remember once throwing tennis balls over a net to Gordon Brown so that he could whack them back across the net for a Daily Mirror photo shoot, I remember once. Nobody was playing tennis with him on the other side of the net. I was just throwing the balls.
And he still hit it really hard.
Very hard. I had to dodge all over the shop. It was a very, very good photo shoot, I remember.
That great clunking fist, perhaps. No, the manager was Harry Redknapp.
Oh, I didn't know that.
In charge of Spurs. There we go. Paul, you've won the quiz 1-0-0. Well done. Unfortunately, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you to my guests for joining me, and make sure you subscribe to Commons People on all the usual channels, and please be sure to leave a review. And get your daily dose of what's happening in Westminster by subscribing to the Warzone newsletter at bit.ly/the-war-zone. We'll just leave you with the Labour MP Lillian Greenwood inadvertently paying tribute to the now sadly departed dance music legends Daft Punk.
Let's go to Lillian Greenwood. Lillian. Just have to pass on.